Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Our first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Horner. Ms. Peterson.
May it please the court. The probationary sentence in this case is unreasonable for a defendant who spent 13 years actively concealing his Swiss bank accounts from the government, as the sentence does not reflect the seriousness of the offense, does not provide for general deterrence, does not promote respect for the law, and creates unwarranted sentencing disparities. The sentence imposed by the district court in this case in no way reflects the egregious details of defendant's conduct. Defendant personally traveled to Switzerland at least twice to open his undeclared bank accounts. He instructed the bank not to contact him in the United States, instructed the bank to destroy account records, sent a letter to the bank threatening that if the bank didn't follow his instructions, quote, there would be consequences. When he believed his account might be detected by the United States government, he moved the account to a smaller, off-the-radar Swiss bank, placing the account in the name of a nominee entity to further conceal his ownership of the account. He lied to his own accountants and to the IRS for over 13 years, and he came clean only when it became clear he might get caught. The district court stated that defendant's charity outweighed...
He hadn't been contacted by the government, though, had he?
He had not. That's correct, Your Honor. He had not been contacted by the government, but he admitted he did not attempt to come clean until he knew his personal Swiss banker had been indicted. At that point, sending him a signal that his own detection was likely.
Okay, let's stop the parade of horribles for a minute, and let's concentrate on why we're here. When you read the entire sentencing transcript, it is really clear that Judge Koukouras focused almost entirely on the history and the character of the defendant, which is a perfectly valid 3553A factor. He did not ignore any of the government's arguments. He simply gave them less weight than the government wanted to give them. He wasn't focused on the amount of money that Warner gave to charity. He was focused on his general character. What he was saying in context, it seems to me, is that his offense of conviction was very much out of character for him. And I, for one, find the government's attempts to compare him to Edward Vidroliak odd indeed.
Well, Your Honor, you're correct. The district court did spend a bulk of the sentencing transcript talking about the defendant's charitable acts and the amount of money that the defendant gave to charity. However, when a district court is weighing the history and characteristics of a defendant, the district court must also weigh bad acts that the defendant has committed. And this was not a one-time aberration on the defendant's part. He committed a course of conduct over 13 years, taking numerous steps to hide his bank account. And the district court failed to view any of these bad acts in the context of the good acts.
Well, it was all part of one act. I mean, all part of one transaction, though.
Well,
separate bad acts. It was... I mean, you could break it down and say every time I suppose he made a deposit. But the idea of creating this offshore account was one act.
Your Honor, it could be viewed sort of...
How many counts did he plead guilty to?
He pled guilty to tax evasion for 1 year, 2002. During that year, at the end of that year, he moved from a large Swiss bank to a smaller Swiss bank. So during the year of conviction, it was two banks. And it wasn't just this isn't just a case where the defendant flew to Switzerland, opened an account, and never thought about it again. He actively, when he thought he was going to be the account was going to be detected, he flew to Switzerland, he moved the money, he opened a nominee account. Defendant had plenty of opportunities to declare the account and failed to do so year after year.
Here's what I am having a problem with. The government is arguing that only a prison sentence was adequate for general deterrence. And I don't understand that in light of the 40,000 people who walked away and were never prosecuted at all, and the 60% of prosecuted defendants who have walked away with probation.
Yes, Your Honor. To address your point sort of in turn, beginning with the voluntary disclosure program, the defendant was not eligible for the voluntary disclosure program because he was already under criminal investigation, and he should not be treated similarly to those who are in the voluntary disclosure program for a few reasons. First of all, the people in the program who were not prosecuted were never found guilty. They never agreed. They never admitted to willful conduct. Some of those individuals did not willfully avoid paying taxes on their accounts. Not only that, but individuals who enter the voluntary disclosure program must do a series of things. They must tell the government the source of the funds. The defendant never did that. They must provide the government with detailed information.
Was there some feeling that the sources were illegal?
Your Honor, it appears that the funds might have been pre-tax because there's no record of a payment from the defendant's personal or corporate accounts to the Swiss bank. So the government could not locate the source of the money or could not account for the defendant ever paying taxes on that money. So it appears the defendant's tax loss might have been severely understated if he opened an account with approximately $80 million of pre-tax money.
You know, the government seems very heavily focused on the size of the tax loss here, which is this roughly $5 million loss. Am I correct that this loss represents approximately one-half of 1% of what Warner has paid in taxes? In other words, if you take a look at the argument that Warner makes at the bottom of page 39, the top of page 40, regarding the comparison of the loss to the overall taxes paid versus charitable giving as a percent of absolute wealth, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Your Honor, that's correct. Defendant has paid a great deal in taxes.
Over a billion?
Over the course of his lifetime. You know, however, the guidelines contemplate, when the guidelines are contemplating loss, they're contemplating loss to the victim, not necessarily how the loss relates to a defendant's overall wealth or lack of wealth. And in this case, $5.5 million is a lot of money to be missing from the Treasury. And
does the government dispute that he's voluntarily not deducted approximately $16 million in charitable giving? How much additional revenue did the government collect because he didn't claim what he could have in charitable contributions? But the way I figure it, it's just about equal to the amount of the tax loss.
Your Honor, I believe this is discussed briefly in our sentencing memorandum, but defendant from tax years 2002 to present had a net operating loss that he carried forward and backward on his tax return. What that means is he had no income on those returns to pay taxes on, so he had nothing to deduct the charitable deductions against. Charitable deductions do show up on his tax return, and he can, you know, accrue the benefit of them in the future because he can carry them forward, but he was not able to take them on his returns.
Let me ask you this. Are you claiming procedural errors in the sentencing process? And if so, I'm wondering where you preserved those arguments, because you raised them in footnotes in the opening brief, and then you brought them up again in the reply, but you never really fleshed them out. What I'd like to know is what specifically are the procedural errors the district court made?
Yes, Your Honor. The government is contending that the district court made both procedural and substantive errors in this case. The two are sort of connected because there's substantial overlap between a procedural reasonableness inquiry and a substantive reasonableness inquiry, as the Second Circuit recently recognized in Park. And so it's hard to divorce one from the other because procedural errors can also be and look like substantive errors.
Okay, so what are they?
In this case, there's at least two procedural errors. The first is that the district court failed to account for defendant's specific egregious criminal conduct. When weighing the history and characteristics of the defendant and the seriousness of the offense, the court focused on good acts but failed to meaningfully discuss or assess the numerous bad acts of the defendant.
Wait a minute. The district court focused not simply on charitable giving but on the defendant's character generally. And that this crime was out of character. Was there any evidence of bad character on Warner's part other than the crime of conviction? You keep talking about bad acts. This is a bad act. There are no bad acts that I can see.
Well, Your Honor, every time the defendant took a step, a further step to conceal his account, which there were numerous acts.
So there are hundreds of bad acts, according to the government.
Well, there are, the defendant...
How many bad acts are there?
Every year the defendant signed a tax return knowing it was false. That's 13 bad acts right there. The defendant then filed amended returns where he also failed to report the account. That's another 4 bad acts. Flying to Switzerland, each of those is a bad act. And at each of those junctures, defendant could have decided, now's a good time to declare the account. I'm on the wrong path. I should come clean. And he did it. Instead...
Oh, he did, though.
He did eventually, but only after he learned his banker had been indicted.
And you didn't have to investigate, convene a grand jury. You didn't have to do anything. He pled guilty, right?
Your Honor, he did plead guilty. That's correct.
That saved the government some money, right?
Yes, and that's incorporated in his guidelines calculation as a 3-level reduction under 3E1.1.
Well, we were talking about bad acts, so is that a good act? Does that count for him other than just the guideline?
I mean, it's a good act. It's not unlike many other defendants who plead guilty. It's not an exceptionally mitigating circumstance to go...
Let me tell you what really bothers me. It's that all of the arguments in the brief, and thus far today, ignore the considerable discretion that district courts enjoy in fashioning sentences. And, you know, you've got Judge Koukouras here. A veteran judge, certainly not. Some bleeding heart. Pollyanna, who obviously agonized over this sentence. Knew it wouldn't be a popular sentence, shall we say. And still did this. What happens to judges with such stellar careers, discretion in your view?
Your Honor, a district court does have discretion to weigh the 3553A factors, but their discretion is not unfettered. There's in each sentence there is a range of sentences that are reasonable, and there are sentences that fall outside that range of reasonableness. And judges do make mistakes from time to time, and in this case, the district court simply assigned too much weight to defendant's charity and ignored other sentencing factors, seriousness of the offense, deterrence, and so forth. And I see that
but there was sentencing prior to the sentencing guidelines where virtually the sentence wasn't appealable. You remember that? Oh, you don't remember.
She wasn't born.
I don't recall that, Your Honor.
But I think there are members of this court who might recall that. And the whole idea is not to make this court the sentencing court.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, this court does retain...
Well, we have to look at things where where the district judge did something wrong.
That's why I was asking.
What did he do wrong?
The procedural errors. I don't, you know.
Ms. Peterson, in light of the extensive question, and I have a couple for you, we will extend by 5 minutes the arguments for both sides.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, what I'd like you to focus on for just a second is what you could help me with.
Yes, Your Honor.
I assume you do not want us to revisit the law of this circuit, which speaks to... this panel or any panel being in a position that they might impose a different sentence than the judge that was.
That's correct,
Your Honor. You're not asking, recently as 07 we did that in Gaul. So you're not asking us to do that.
No, Your Honor.
All right. The government in this case chose to ask for something, quote, in excess of a year and a day.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, during sentencing, the government pointed out that a guidelines range would best minimize unwarranted sentencing disparities, and then pointed out some somewhat similarly situated defendants and asked for a sentence, a floor of a year and a day, a sentence of greater than a year and a day.
Now, what should a district judge make of the government in the context of a case of this size? When I mean size, I'm talking about the enormity of the invasion, tax evasion.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is it a district judge to make when the government takes the position obviously citing the guidelines, but hopefully every district judge was also aware of it. What is the district judge to make when the government states they want something in excess of a year to a year and a day? Should he factor that in as a position of the government as somewhat less than the guideline range?
Yes, I think the district court can, Your Honor. And I think in this case it was a reflection of the fact that some other similarly situated defendants received terms of incarceration, but that were, you know, perhaps less than their guidelines range.
But wasn't this a case where the dollar amount was considerably higher than those cases?
Yes. At the time of sentencing, defendant had the highest tax loss of any former UBS client.
And the government presented to the judge arguably a possible position for acceptance that was significantly less than the guidelines.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, I don't want to get in, nor should I, into the mind of the Department of Justice, either into the whole voluntariness program of the Executive Department or not. But it does cause me a little concern that in a case of this size, the government, and I have a follow-up question, comes in suggesting a sentence that has been meted out in other custody sentences. So can you see my concern that you've started the judge down the road of a kind of a minimalist approach to custody?
I do understand your concern, Your Honor. I do think that there is a big difference between a term of incarceration and a term of probation.
Indeed. So would we be here, Ms. Peterson, if Judge Koukouras had given the defendant 30 days?
Your Honor, I don't know if we would be here.
Well, you represent the Department of Justice today.
Yes, I do. The government believes that any sentence below a year and a day would continue to create unwarranted sentencing disparities.
And the number of counts in this case?
He pled guilty to one count, Your Honor.
One count. I assume the government had a pretty significant case. And if this is to be somewhat of a landmark case, and again, it's your discretion, not the judicial branch, to present a case of this size with one count and then rely heavily on what my colleague Judge Rovner suggested, other conduct. Do you see where I'm coming from? I'm just trying to present the context in which the government chose to indict and to recommend sentence. And I appreciate your argument about custody versus no custody. But that's the one that gives me a little pause when the government speaks to what we must look at, that is an abuse of discretion. Do you think we should look at all to the discretion exercised in the quality and extent of the prosecution?
Your Honor, to speak to your point about one count, the defendant pled guilty to an information, and in his plea he did admit to relevant conduct spanning 13 years. That's why there was only one count in the information. I think that the government's recommendation was sort of a reflection that a below-guideline sentence might best minimize unwarranted sentencing disparities, but it was certainly not a reflection that the government did not think this was serious, and in fact there was extensive argument about the seriousness at sentencing.
I'd like to follow that up. Now I'm wondering, should we be comparing the sentence of probation to the guidelines range or to that one-year sentence that the government requested when we are assessing how much justification the district court must provide for departing?
Well, Your Honor, the appellate court's review, just like the district court's review, should start with the guidelines as the beginning of the analysis and go from there. So I believe the court would look to the guidelines range and then look at the amount of departure and try to figure out whether or not the 3553A factors support such a departure.
And is that what the government did when it came in and asked for that year?
Well, Your Honor, the government, that's a reflection of the government's assessment of 3553A6 sentencing disparities. Okay, seeing as I'm in my rebuttal time.
Counsel, just for the benefit for perhaps some of the people in the audience, could you explain the difference between a year and a day?
Yes, Your Honor. Any sentence over a year, the defendant gets some credit for
time served.
So he would serve.
So it's less than a year.
Less than a year. That's correct.
So we're not even talking about a year, and this what you recommended. We're talking about less than a year.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Like
so again,
8 months or 9 months, maybe
somewhere between 8 and 9 months. Yes. Seeing as how I'm in my rebuttal time, I will reserve the remainder of my
sure.
time.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. Mr. Clement.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case involves, at least primarily, a substantive reasonableness challenge to the single most commonly imposed sentence for the crime that was charged in this case. Now, the parties had no dispute about the proper calculation of the guidelines range, and indeed, as you've just heard, there was no dispute between the parties that a sentence substantially below the guidelines range was appropriate in this case. And so what that left the district court with was really a choice between the government's submission that the sentence should be a year and a day and our submission that under the very unique circumstances of this individual and his specific circumstances that a probationary sentence, the same sentence that was given to well over half of the people who've been charged with this same crime, would be appropriate. Where it leaves this court, of course, is with, I think, what really is a substantive reasonableness challenge. I don't think that there is any significant procedural error. I think at the end of the day, the government's suggestion in footnotes of procedural error is really amounts to nothing more than the fact that they don't like the fact that in balancing the factors under 3553A, which the district court quite correctly and obviously recognized point in different factors, I think they just don't like the way he balanced them. And I think there were some factors that supported a probationary sentence, some factors that supported a sentence of incarceration, and they don't like the fact that the judge, at the end of the day, put more weight on those factors that he thought, in his judgment, reflected a probationary sentence.
If you take a look at page 51 of the opening brief, the government contends that sentencing Warner to probation leaves no room to sentence less culpable defendants to proportionately less severe terms. So why don't you respond to that argument?
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, I think that's demonstrably not true, which is to say that, I mean, on a number of levels, I mean, if you look at their reply brief, they talk about a subsequent case where they prosecuted somebody and got a 2-year sentence of incarceration. Now, there may have been differences in that case. I don't have right in front of me the dollar amount of that case. It was another substantial amount involved. But what that shows is that each district court judge, if they're doing their job, are going to look at the facts and circumstances of all of the 3553A factors. And I would think that any other district court judge that bothers to look at the transcript of the sentencing hearing is going to realize that this is a ticket good for one trade only, and that they're going to have to look at the individual circumstances of the person that they have in front of them. And I think they're going to come up with their sentence. And I do think that there is, as a number of the questions have pointed to, a great deal of discretion that district courts have in sentencing, and that sentencing is that discretion has to be respected on appeal. I think if the sentence had been imposed was a year and a day, I don't know that we'd be here appealing that sentence, because we would recognize the substantial discretion that district courts have to make these judgments. And in a sense, the government's position on appeal, I think, is and Judge Flom, I think your questions went to this, I mean, is really a difficult position, because the way this case was briefed to the district court judge, this really came down to almost a binary choice between a year and a day and a substantial probationary sentence with civil fines and community service and the like. And I mean, how can it be an abuse of discretion for the district court judge to pick one of the two options that was put in front of him when there's only a year difference between the two options? I don't think abuse of discretion review is so demanding that it basically says that the government, when it puts the district court judge to that kind of choice, can get an appellate reversal of that.
Is the government correct that the FBAR penalty was not the highest civil penalty he could have faced?
They're right, but there's context to that, which is in order for them to get in a dispute that was not resolved as part of a negotiated plea agreement the way this was, for them to get any FBAR penalty, they would have to show the willfulness of the withholding of the FBAR. And we have some arguments in this case about that. I'm happy to share them with you, but I think they're sort of ultimately beside the point, which is to say we would have some arguments about that. If they proved their case, they could get as many as, I think, 3 years of FBAR penalties. But here's, I think, the other piece of context that's important. We didn't get this 50% of 1 year FBAR penalty because my fine co-counsel are excellent negotiators. They happen to be excellent negotiators, but that's not why we got this. We got this because this is the standard cookie-cutter approach that the government uses when they resolve these cases through plea bargains. So 50% of 1 year of an FBAR is basically kind of the standard going rate of this. So this is not some incredible concession that we got. I do think that the FBAR penalty in particular does speak to one of the 3553A factors, which is deterrence. Because when you're thinking about this whole area of the law, I mean, it is, I think, quite relevant that the FBAR penalty that the government agreed to here is 10 times the tax loss. And so I think when you're talking about sort of somebody else out there trying to make a decision, I think the fact that they risk 10 times the loss would be one thing that would consider them. And again, I would concern them. And I think the other thing is if they actually looked at this sentencing hearing and looked at all of the highly individualized circumstances that the district court took into account, and the fact that he basically starts the process off by talking about the uniqueness of the individual in front of him, I doubt that somebody else who has a different background, and very few people are going to have this kind of history of humanitarian actions, I don't think they're going to get a lot of comfort from the fact that this particular defendant was able to get a probationary sentence.
Well, we realize that, for example, here, motive is not an issue that has to be proven. But did your client speak to that at all, why he did what he did, from the fact that you don't pay taxes?
I mean, he certainly spoke to it in the sense of having great regret for the decision he made. And, you know, we're not here to minimize the crime or to try to cover up the fact that he made a grave mistake that has had criminal consequences. I do think, though, that in considering the nature of his actions, I think the government is really gilding the lily by saying that this is like a whole pattern of bad acts. I mean, if you're going to have a bank account in another country that's undisclosed, I mean, he really did, with the exception of changing it from one bank to another at one point, other than that, he really did sort of the minimum necessary in order to do that. I mean, you can't have an undisclosed account if you don't fail to disclose it on the FBAR year after year after year. And I think that's important because when you look at the other sentences out there, this kind of pattern of, for the period that the account was there, of not filing the FBARs and filing tax returns that did not account for it, that's going to be true in every one of those cases. You know, this is not something where that marks his conduct as outlying. And if you compare that to some of the cases we talked about in the briefs, there you have cases that with people that had multiple accounts or actually were intermediaries for others, and I think that's the kind of additional conduct that might mark somebody out of the mainstream of people who have been convicted for this offense. I would like to talk, if I could, just for a minute about the amnesty program, because I do think, although it may not be directly relevant, I think it helps explain why you do have this dynamic of over half the people charged with this crime get a probationary sentence. It's not my job either to try to figure out what's in the government's mind, but I have to imagine that amnesty program is what influenced them to seek a year and a day for the sentence in this case. And what I want to emphasize is that my client was not turned down for that program because the amount of the tax loss was too high. If you satisfied their criteria, they took all comers, and in a sense, since the amnesty program was designed to get revenue back in the system, the bigger account, the better. He was not denied access to that program because he moved the account from one bank to another. He was not denied access to that account because he filed 12 forms that the government thinks is mistaken instead of 6. There's no limit on that. He was turned down for one and only one reason, which is they already had his name on a list. And that's their prosecutorial discretion. We don't take issue with that, but it is a finding of the district court judge that the defendant did not know that fact. And so he comes into that program thinking that he's going to come fully clean, give them all the information that they want, and he's denied that opportunity.
That was a question that I asked because he didn't know that he was on their list. But he did know, and how did this come out, that he did know that the banker had been investigated or indicted or whatever?
I believe there were public reports that the banker that he dealt with was under investigation. But even that, I think you have to put into context here and really, I think you have to focus on the context of these offshore cases and understand that they're different, and I think they're part of what led the government to behave in the way that it behaved here, which is Yeah, he knew that his specific banker was under investigation, and maybe that put him at a different level. Again, the fact that he knew, though, that his banker was under investigation is not what got him rejected from the program. It was that he was on that list. But this amnesty program is being offered in the immediate wake of the government announcing with considerable fanfare that they've basically finally broken Swiss bank secrecy. So everybody, all of the tens of the thousands of people who come into this program are not coming into this program because they've had a complete change of heart, they've recognized the error of their ways, and they've decided they want to come clean with the government. They're all coming in at some level because the gig is up. The jig is up. It's, you know, Swiss bank secrecy is not what it is. And the government made a conscious decision to say that rather than try to prosecute all of these tens of thousands of people, we're going to divert most of them entirely from the criminal system. And we're not here to say that, you know, we don't question their act of prosecutorial discretion, but I think it's going to have some collateral consequences. And it makes this a particularly, I think, difficult case for the government to be arguing that this is a substantively unreasonable sentence.
Was this program a discretionary thing with the Department of Justice, or was there a congressional act involved, the amnesty?
As I understand it, it was all executive branch prosecutorial discretion. And I think, if anything, Congress has had some hearings about whether they were sort of too lenient in some of the ways that they've handled this. This was not a congressional direction. And again, we don't take issue with it. Where we really think it informs things, though, is that, you know, what the government's really principal argument as to why the defendant here is so much worse than all of these other people that have been convicted and gotten probationary sentences is the amount of money at stake. And I do think in making that argument, it is at least relevant that this amnesty program is open without a ceiling. You know, again, it's not like my client was rejected from the amnesty program because his account holding was above some threshold that they had decided as an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. And if that had been the case, I think they'd be in a much better position to insist on a more significant sentence. But they're not in that position. I don't think have any dispute with our statement that there are plenty of people in the amnesty program who had greater amounts at issue than my client. And I do think that that's what carried over to them in seeking what is really a substantially below guideline sentence themselves.
Mr. Clement, accepting the amnesty program for the sake of discussion as cabining our thoughts right now, and also accepting your position that understandably that every defendant's facts stand separate to be considered individually, should we look at all at the enormity of the amount? And should that in any way factor into the reasonableness?
Sure, it goes into the calculus. I'm not here to tell you that the amount is irrelevant. It's certainly the way that the guidelines work. You know, the reason that the guidelines range is maybe higher than this case and some of the other cases is precisely that tax loss amount. So I think it's part of what goes into the analysis, but I don't think that it has dispositive significance. I don't think there's some threshold where if all of the other considerations of the defendant's character point in the direction of a probationary sentence, there's an amount that you can't go above to counteract those. And I think if you start thinking about the appellate review that way, you actually start to reintroduce some Sixth Amendment problems.
We are directed to look at the enormity or the amount of his charitable acts, not just the number, because I suspect there may be charitable acts in the background of others who been sentenced but just didn't have the financial capacity to make the dollar amounts. So are we to look at his charitable acts because they're the enormity of the amounts he used, or as well as the number of charitable acts?
I think it's really the latter, Your Honor, and I think that's what principally goes to the character of the defendant, which is ultimately why those charitable acts are relevant. And I actually think, you know, the government made this same argument that, boy, you know, this is a wealthy individual, so of course there's going to be some charitable contributions. And the district court heard those arguments, and I think he credited them in part, which is why in his sentencing hearing transcript, he really focuses on what the charitable actions say about the nature of the individual and not simply the amount of the charitable contributions. Many the letters he read principally are about actions as opposed to checks. Even the ones where there is a check involved, he's not focused, the district court's not focused on the amount of the check that's written, but really the context. So just to give you an example, in the context of the Children's Hunger Fund, there are hundreds of millions, there are tens of millions of Beanie Babies that are donated to that organization that are worth close to $100 million. But that's not the paragraph that the district court wants to focus on. What the district court wants to focus on is that even though this organization was trying to say you really need to take credit for all of your doing and make this more public than it already is, that the defendant declined that. And so I really do think the district court was doing exactly what you're supposed to do, which is not focus on the numbers, but really focus on the nature of the actions.
Well, should it be looked at at all outside the tax evasion context? Should it be looked at in just general sentencing for any crime?
I think those are all fair factors and proper factors. And I do think, with all due respect to the government, in a way they're being unfair to the district court here, because they point to this transcript where there is a lot of discussion of the charitable actions of the defendant. But, of course, this circuit's own case law suggests that in order for the charitable activities to count, they have to be exceptional. So in that context, I don't see how the district court can be faulted for going out of his way to saying, look, this is not like the Repkin case, for example, where it's just an offhanded reference to some charitable acts. He details the acts and then explains why they really go to the character of the individual in a way that's very unique.
Well, the fine imposed in this was somewhere I read the largest, at least at that point, the largest imposed.
Yes, it was at that point, I think, was the largest civil fine that had been imposed in that. Now, of course, that's driven by the numbers at issue here, so I don't want to place too much weight on that. I really think the most significant thing is that fine is 10 times the amount of the tax loss. So right there, you have substantial deterrent effect.
Yeah, but against Mr. Clement, but against net worth, I don't want to say it's de minimis, but it isn't tremendous.
You're right, Your Honor. But look, this is a case where both sides at various points want you to look at a big number and credit in various ways. I think the relative numbers are what's actually more important in the context of this, and that's why the point that came out during the government's argument about how much legitimate taxes that this defendant paid is actually pretty relevant as well. Because I think if you were assessing two individual defendants, right, if you had somebody who essentially reduce their tax burden in half by having substantial income in undisclosed accounts, I think that person is more culpable than somebody with a slightly higher absolute amount, but it's really pittance in terms of their overall contribution to the tax rolls.
Would you say the record reflects an equal consideration by the district judge, not only on the number of charitable acts and the enormity or sweep of them, as well as he did on the profile, the high profile of this individual?
Well, I think he may have focused more on the former than the latter. And again, though, I think that is not error. I think it's a reflection of this court's case law, which does make the suggestion that if you're going to look to charitable conduct, you both have to document it and you have to really explain why it's exceptional and not sort of the mine run type of charitable activity. And so I think that's what's reflected in the opinion. The two thoughts I would leave you with are this. I think there's two ways of looking at the question presented here, both of which lead you to the result that this is not an abuse of discretion. The one I've already talked about is that ultimately the way this was litigated, it was a choice between a year and a day and a probationary sentence with a substantial amount of community service. If that's the choice that's before the district court and it's not just a huge chasm between the two, I don't see how it can be abuse of discretion.
Well, just to follow up, sort of a corollary to my inquiry of Ms. Peterson, then if the government had asked for near or at the top of the guideline range, then and we had the sentence that was imposed here, would you be arguing that it still was not an abuse of discretion to give probation?
I would still be arguing that, but I think it would be a harder argument, Your Honor. I mean, I will concede that. The only other way of looking at it, and the last thing I'll say before I sit down, is I do think the other way of looking at it is whether it can possibly be an abuse of discretion for a district court judge to give the single most common sentence for a particular crime. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Clement. Ms. Peterson.
Uh, My colleague characterizes the district court's inquiry and rationale at sentencing as being an individualized assessment of the defendant. However, an individualized assessment of the defendant is not enough. The district court also must look at the goals in 3553A and make sure that the sentence comports with those goals.
Do you think he could have done a more thorough job of evaluating all of the Section 3553A factors? Could it be possible?
Your Honor, yes, I think the court could have done a more thorough job of discussing all of the sentencing goals. But even if the court had, this sentence would still be substantively unreasonable because it simply doesn't meet a number of the sentencing goals. It doesn't promote deterrence. Doesn't provide for deterrence. This court and the Sentencing Commission have recognized that tax evasion is sort of one of the most important. In a tax evasion case, deterrence is one of the most important 3553A factors, and that's.
And the government chooses to charge one count on one of the most egregious offshore cases that obviously has been brought by the department to date.
Well, yes, Your Honor. Again, it was a one count information because defendant pleaded guilty. I'd also like to sort of go back to this.
Wait a minute. You agreed to this.
Yes.
The government agreed to this.
Yes, the defendant agreed to plead to information, but all of the defendant's years of tax evasion were part of the relevant conduct in the plea. So the plea incorporates his failure to pay taxes from 1996.
Well, how does that fit into your deterrence? So you have somebody who's the most egregious tax evader you could find, and you charge him with one count and recommend today? That doesn't sound to me like deterrence.
Well, Your Honor, again...
How can the government argue that the district judge should really deter by imposing a substantial sentence and you come in with one count and a year and a day?
Your Honor, I apologize if I wasn't clear in the beginning, but the government wasn't asking for a year and a day. The government pointed out all these similarly... May I finish my...
Of course.
Pointed out all these similarly situated defendants and how the defendant was more egregious than them, and thus a sentence of more than a year and a day would be appropriate. So the government wasn't asking for a year and a day specifically, but sort of setting a floor by which the court should rise above.
Well, I guess the thrust of my question is you're really focusing on deterrence, but the nature of the charge and the way that you argued it should be more than a year and a day is not really a deterrence, much more than what the district judge gave.
Again, Your Honor, prison, a term of incarceration is qualitatively different than a term of incarceration. And a term of probation sends a message to would-be taxpayers.
Well, yeah, and a year and a day is a little less than 57 months.
Yes, Your Honor, but any term of incarceration would help deter a would-be tax evader because otherwise a tax evader might think, well, probation isn't really so bad. I'm willing to take the risk and evade my taxes.
Or he might get an amnesty program.
Yes, Your Honor. Seeing as my time has expired, the sentence in this case does not reflect the egregious nature of defendant's conduct. It won't deter tax evaders, and we respectfully request the court remand the case for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under